We always begin our conference with a talk on the context for doing inner work. And Larry Mays and I and Joyce and Susan Sims-Smith sort of rotate doing that. And so today it's our pleasure to have Larry. Larry?
The title of this first talk is The Context for Braving the Inner Journey. And if you don't believe that context is important, I decided I would tell you the latest preacher joke that's making the rounds. Someone from Georgia sent it to me last week, so you in Georgia, your preacher's probably already told this story. But, you know, it takes a little longer to get past the Mississippi. The story goes that the preacher has decided that he has to liven up his sermons, liven them up with a visual aid. And so he gets four containers and four earthworms. First container, he puts Jack Daniels. If you don't know what Jack Daniels is, it's whiskey. Good whiskey. I wouldn't have used Jack Daniels myself for this, but second container, he takes in a big puff of smoke and fills the container full of smoke and quickly puts the top back on with the earthworm inside. The third, he fills up with chocolate and an earthworm. And the fourth is just good, rich, dark soil and the earthworm. So all four containers have a substance and an earthworm. And he goes on then with, as some preachers can do, a very long sermon about the evils of overindulging in any of those ways. And at the end of the sermon, he uses his visual aid to reveal the truth. In the first, he pulls off the top of the Jack Daniels a dead earthworm. The second, filled with smoke, a dead earthworm. Third, filled with chocolate, a dead earthworm. The fourth, filled with good soil, a very lively, healthy earthworm. And he says, now, what do we learn from this? And from the back pew comes a voice saying, I think if you drink whiskey and smoke cigarettes and eat a lot of chocolate, you won't have worms. That's my kind of parishioner. So, context is important. If you're like me, you probably have a certain number of people around you who wonder why we would be spending all this time and energy doing some kind of what they call navel-gazing and self-indulgent meandering in dreams and other kinds of inner work. Why, they say, with all the ills of the world, would we be paying all this attention to ourselves, especially in such an exact pastime as trying to figure out what our brain has been doing while we've been sleeping? I've certainly run into those who thought a bishop of the church should find better ways to use energy than to talk about dreams. But then when I would talk about other things, they would decide that this was a fairly harmless activity and would encourage that I get back to this subject. The truth is, I think, taken in context, there may be no more important work for us than to be about the business of trying to discover the mysteries that lie within, deep within, every human being. And so frequently those mysteries control our behaviors without our even knowing about it. In fact, it is my fear that most of the political systems on this planet are under the influence of people who have very little interest in what lies hidden in their soul, and we're living with the results of that on the political stage. And so we begin our time together here at Kanuga with a word or two about context. Robert Johnson, one of my favorite teachers and writers and mentor in the field of inner work and dream work, begins his 1998 memoir called Balancing Heaven and Earth with these remarks. He says, "It is an audacious notion to put forth in this age of science and willful determination that one's existence is somehow inspired, guided, and even managed by unseen forces outside our control, whether called fate, destiny, or the hand of God. Slender threads are at work, bringing coherence and continuity to our lives. Over time, they weave a remarkable tapestry." I agree with Robert Johnson that in this day and age, to even suggest that there may be something divine, some slender threads working within the soul of each one of us, trying to help us make sense of our lives, very often falls on deaf ears, because there's very little empiricism involved in talking about these slender threads. I began to suspect that to be true, I would guess, in about the fourth decade of my life. I was educated and trained in theology. By then, I had been ordained for 10 or 15 years. I believed very deeply in what the church had equipped me to do, and I began to have a sense that most of the decisions that I had made along the way that turned out to be life-giving, even transformational decisions, I began to have the sense that those were decisions that I had been led into. Some of them, quite clearly, were not my idea at all. Further, I began to have a sense that there had been built around me a kind of protection that kept my bad decisions, and there were plenty of them, from permanently keeping me from what? From, I'm not always sure even now, keeping me from living into that unique identity that is, I think, part of a cosmic design beyond my knowing. You have one of those as well. That unique identity that is part of the cosmic design, the unfolding of history. Obviously, what Robert Johnson speaks of as the slender threads being woven together in the tapestry of each individual life is what Christians call the hand of God. We believe in God, who is active and involved in what God has created. We don't believe in the clockmaker concept of God, who wound up creation, stepped back, and now is sort of enjoying seeing how it all turns out. We believe in God who is somehow impacted by us, impacted by what goes on with us day in and day out. I, at least, have not always believed that God was weaving the tapestry of my life as though that tapestry was essential to the cosmic unfolding of history. It's one thing to have that vague sense that God's hand is at work in the world about us. You know, that thing that we learn very early, God is everywhere, God is in all things, etc., and so on. It's one thing to believe that, But it's quite another to believe that God is quite literally weaving one's life together in the hour-by-hour decisions of ordinary living, and doing it because somehow the weaving together of each individual life is important, if indeed not necessary, for the unfolding cosmos. Much of American Christianity, if not global Christianity, has been misrepresented as something of a contest between good and evil, with hapless humanity sort of stuck in the middle. That certainly seems true, where following Christ has been reduced to a sort of rule book for good behavior. And in that understanding of God's activity, there's very little sense that God is persistently involved with us, persistently weaving our lives to become part of the essential fabric of history. Now, in the middle of my sixth decade, I no longer just suspect that to be true. I find that it is true, and has been true throughout my life. It's true that with the benefits of age and some degree of maturity, I can look back and see some of the threads that I followed. Some of the threads that I followed and transformed my life. It is also true that I can look back and see those times that I resisted the slender threads that Robert talks about. I resisted them for any number of reasons that seemed important to my ego at the time. And the graceful truth is that while I was resisting the slender threads, the weaving didn't stop because of my resistance. But neither did the weaver change the pattern to something less. The weaver never threw up those cosmic hands to say, "This is a mistake." The pattern of life remains the same, and the weaver is very patient. Sometimes, just as Jesus taught, the wheat and the tares just have to grow side by side until the harvest, and then we can figure it out. I'm convinced, as is Robert Johnson and lots of other people who have engaged the inner life, that there is a divine interest in my becoming and your becoming the unique people that the cosmic unfolding requires. Now, I say all of that because the work we're going to be about all of this week will be enhanced if we begin by creating that rather grand context. Too many people, I think, understand all of this as an interesting hobby, a little avocation on the side. True, we're here to talk about dreams and their meaning, which holds real interest for many people these days, because frankly, any opportunity to talk about ourselves can be fun. It can also be less than fun from time to time. That is, to know more about ourselves in any deep and abiding way. But as the country singer says, I want to talk about me. The ego gets all excited about me. It's the job of the ego to know me and to be able to present me in the best possible light. And some of the interest in dreams comes from simply that. My dreams are about me. You can't have my dreams. I can't have your dreams. It's just about me. The truth is, however, that the ego isn't always happy when we get involved in serious dream work, because dreams bypass the ego and go directly to the storehouse of the unconscious to reveal that which we don't know about ourselves and which the ego doesn't know, and therefore which the ego cannot control. An example comes from Carl Jung himself in a dream that served as something as of a precursor to his work with the shadow. Here is the dream in his own words. "I had a dream which both frightened and encouraged me. It was night in some unknown place, and I was making slow and painful headway against a mighty wind. Dense fog was flying along everywhere. I had my hands cupped around a tiny light which threatened to go out at any moment. Everything depended on my keeping this little light alive. Suddenly, I had the feeling that something was coming up behind me. I looked back and saw a gigantic black figure following me. But at the same moment, I was conscious, in spite of my terror, that I must keep my little light going through the night and the wind, regardless of all danger. When I awoke, I realized at once that the figure was my own shadow on the swirling mist, brought into being by the little light I was carrying. I knew, too, that this little light was my consciousness, the only light I have." End of quote. In various ways this week, many of us will be talking in some detail about the formation of the shadow, or the unconscious that resides within each one of us. And though out of conscious thought still plays a powerful hand in shaping us into particular human beings. In fact, that which is unconscious often causes us to think and behave in particular ways which can be a mystery to us and everyone else. To some degree, we're here to prove the error in the cliché, "what you don't know won't hurt you." Frequently, it is the very opposite of that. What resides in the unconscious, left unaddressed and unhonored, can very easily hurt us when it finally finds a way to get our attention. And so we will spend some time, perhaps in each of the talks to be given in each workshop, to at some degree we will be spending time looking at what lies hidden in the soul of every one of us as a way of responding to that kind of dream that Jung had, where the only light we have is consciousness. But for the moment, let me simply say that serious attention to our dreams is self-discovery, beyond the control of what the ego will line up for us at any given time. And yet that self-discovery holds the promise of bringing the ego into some profound learning about me, the me of the ego. It's one of the deep tensions that we all live with. We live with an ego that is generally contented with what it already knows. God knows that it took long enough to get to this ego strength, and the ego is generally quite contented to stay there. And yet there is tension with the deeper self that keeps telling the ego more than it wants to hear, most often while the ego's defenses are down, that is, while we're sleeping. In the opening years of the 20th century, work with the unconscious, and particularly with the unconscious that is discoverable in dreams, powerfully impacted by the work of Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung. Carl Jung, in particular, because of his openness to religion and the mysteries of spirituality. The more I read of Carl Jung's own work, the more I realize that even though he had a certain suspicion of organized religion, he was something of a mystic himself in terms of the spiritual side of life. And so much of the modern dream work that we will be encountering this week finds its roots in the work of Carl Jung. Much of the language of modern psychotherapy is language born since the beginning of the last century. And in the days ahead, you will note that many of those insights will have started with the work of Jung. But obviously, dreams have existed from the beginning. And dream work has gone on for generations before we ever learned any Jungian language. The Bible is replete with examples of dreams and with people working their dreams, trying to understand the meaning of what went on when they were in the unconscious. In Scripture, dreams came as messages from God, and yet they often used the same kind of rich imagery as we modern dreamers find in our own. Now, it's true, there are dreams in Holy Scripture that are pretty clear and to the point, like Joseph's dream. Do not fear to take Mary as your wife is a pretty clear message. You note there, parenthetically, that the dream doesn't tell Joseph what to do. It simply says, don't be afraid to take Mary as your wife. Dreams very seldom tell us what to do, but very often will give us evidence as we examine the possibilities of our lives. But there are also dreams like Jacob's famous dream with angels ascending and descending, marking a holy moment and a holy ground. And as Jacob grapples with that dream and that new sense of holiness, his life begins to change. He becomes indeed a different person. And then there were Joseph's many dreams, the dream of the sheaves of wheat bowing down before his own sheaf, a dream rich in imagery, unpopular with his brothers, but rich in imagery. These dreams are perhaps more like your own dreams, dreams with images that when we wake up, we realize it's going to require some work. It's going to require moving into that rich right brain activity of exploring metaphor and image. My point is only that the new language for dream work and new insights about the unconscious inner realm contained in each one of us shouldn't lead us to believe that somehow this is new territory. Indeed, from the earliest evidence of holy writings, Judeo-Christian, but other strands as well, there has existed the belief that the divine permeates all of creation and is constantly being revealed in the world about us, in the wonder of the universe, in the mystery of those moments when ordinary reality suddenly unveils holiness that is beyond explanation, in the ability of the human mind to soar beyond itself in a desire to connect with the source of being, and in those inner mysteries that seem to rise up from our own souls. Who am I? Why am I? All of that is evidence of the divine within each human soul. The divine as it hints at ways of being discovered, as God takes the initiative, always the initiative, to be discovered in the midst of what God has created. The great religions of the world have been, I think, at their best when that mysterious journey towards the divine is enabled and encouraged. But too often, I think, modern and postmodern expressions of religion have adopted a kind of simplistic dualism that implies that God is totally other and is discoverable primarily within the doctrine and theological intricacy of a given church. Climate, the great symbols of being connected to the divine, can in fact be stripped of their mystery and become simply cultic expressions of a given theological prejudice. If you think about those most dynamic symbols of your own faith, whether it be from organized religion or a faith that you have created for your own self, those metaphors of the divine are rich when they connect us to the divine, not when they lapse into theological jargon. I think of the Holy Eucharist, for example, the center of much of the life of at least the Episcopal Church, as well as others. We say in the Mass that we are doing this mysterious work of offering Eucharist so that the divine may dwell in us and we might dwell in the divine. And that's the richness of the sacrament, that Christ may dwell in us and that we may dwell in Him, that we may come into that place where Susan was talking this morning in the Eucharist, where we abide in the divine, not where we sort of move in and out, not where we do certain things that are holy and then we get back to real life, but we abide there. And yet, so often what happens is the church, in its institutional frailty, forgets that we believe that Christ dwells within us, and we begin to agonize over whether or not the words of the Mass should be changed. Should the 1928 prayer book really be changed at all? That's what I mean when I say that sometimes in organized religion, of which I am a part, and which I find to be life-giving. But so often in the frailty of organized religion, what happens is that what gives us can get lost in sort of a cultic expression of how to do it right, or what it's supposed to look like, or who's supposed to be doing what, and how displeased God was. The great wisdom writings of the Old Testament and the period between the Old and New Testament carry that strand of understanding God not as the other, remote and reachable only through cultic practice, but as being embedded in history and in fact embedded in all of creation. The way of wisdom is a system that relies upon humanity's responsibility and yearning to discover God and God's will for the individual and for the world. But it's a system that understands that God is always the one instigating the discovery. In the writings of such books as Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Job, and in the apocryphal books of Sirach and the Book of Wisdom, you find very little language of, "Thus saith the Lord." because it is the nature of the wisdom tradition that wisdom is not speaking from out there, but wisdom is rising up within the soul of the person and, in fact, within the dynamics of creation, because God is in all that God has done. I think of it as God, the creator of all that is, imbuing the created order with the same divine energy that was used to bring about creation in the first place. Whether we're talking about the creation of the universe or whether we're talking about some particle of the universe like you and me. Said differently, the energy of the composer or the artist never leaves that which has been created. Museums and concert halls are filled with the energy of people long gone from sight. So, I believe, God's own energy, and some have learned to call this energy wisdom, and some Yahweh, and some Christ, and some Holy Spirit, and perhaps other names as well. But this same energy is still moving throughout creation. God's own energy is still among us to lead us by what Robert Johnson calls those slender threads, those slender strands that invite us into a particular pathway of self-discovery and self-revelation that is essential to the unfolding cosmos. That, in my mind, is the proper context for taking the sometimes scary journey into the unconscious. We find God there, ready to reveal to us more and more and more about our reason for being. That is the proper context for doing dream work. Our dreams are already showing us hidden truths about ourselves, not just to satisfy our unending curiosity about me, but to reveal more and more and more of what God had in mind for us from the beginning. Dream work is to respond to wisdom as it is uniquely situated in each individual. It's holy work and can be rightly placed next to all of the holy activities religious people undertake and find life-giving. Indeed, it is the inner journey that leads to the wisdom of God that may hold our best hope for meeting the collective darkness that is all about us. Because each time the darkness of one individual soul is brought into the light of consciousness, the light of wholeness, the weight of the collective darkness is a little lighter. So the context for our work this week is not idle curiosity or self-indulgent navel-gazing, or simply an interest in talking about me. The context for our work during this time together may be to save the planet, may be to save the very context in which human life is presently being lived, as one looks about and sees the darkness all around us. We have great evidence of those absolutely unaffected by the mysteries of their own soul. And so perhaps indeed it is up to those of us willing to at least find some light and lessen the weight of that heavy, heavy darkness of the collective. Richard Rohr says that we are people who live on the circumference. Circumference people. We live out here on the edge of things, and we experience life always on the edge. And as a result of that, anything beyond that superficial edge alarms us. And he says, we are people unaccustomed to being invited into the center. Into the center where the meaning is. And yes, where some fearsome darkness might lie. But the invitation of this week is to leave the circumference, the superficial, and to make a journey into the center and to discover where the light can bring indeed health and wholeness to you, and in so doing, bring health and wholeness a little bit more to this planet. So I pray God's blessing upon you as you do that, as you do this important work, not as a little hobby or avocation, but as the life-giving work of this planet. Thank you.